Our text for this morning is the Gospel of Matthew in the 5th chapter, verses 13 through 16. It's a well-known text because of its powerful images or metaphors used to illustrate the Christian life. Matthew 5, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on the hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under a peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, I grew up in the northern Great Plains of the United States, where extreme cold and heavy snow is very typical in winter. Our family also drove 50 kilometers to another town every week to attend church. And sometimes those things, the weather and the long drive to church, came together to produce some adventure. We would arrive at church for Wednesday night Bible study, for example, with a light snow falling. That was not an uncommon occurrence. There's nothing to worry about. An inch of snow here or there isn't going to cause anybody from South Dakota to freak out. However, sometimes we would come out of church after Bible study and find that that light snow had turned into a howling blizzard in the meantime. And when the temperature is just below freezing, this is really a problem. If it's really cold, like 20 or 30 degrees below freezing Celsius or below zero Celsius, then it's no problem. But when it's just below freezing, then a driving snowstorm is a major problem. You see, the heavy, wet snowflakes will accumulate on the windscreen faster than your wipers can clean them off. Eventually, what happens is the wipers get stuck because of the mass of snow, and they can't even move. And I recall more than one or two evenings driving home from church at about 40 k's an hour, kind of with a cane out the window tapping to make sure you don't drive in the ditch. I remember driving home on nights like that and having to stop the car every few minutes and get out, actually, and clean the windscreen off because the windshield wipers just couldn't cope. Now, if you did only that, however, you would very soon be in trouble if you cleaned only the windscreen. Why is that? Because the windscreen is not the only place that snow accumulates. The wet, clogging snow also will stick to your headlights. And so, if you don't clear them off regularly as well, you soon be driving by the equivalent of a dying torch. You'll be in the dark. Well, unfortunately, some Christians' lives are a bit like those snow-plastered headlights. They're supposed to be the light of the world, according to Matthew 5, but they're so clogged up with a light-dimming worldliness that they hardly shine anymore. Or, if you wanted to borrow Jesus' taste metaphor, you could say it this way. Some professing believers are like soda pop. They're like soda pop that has been left open in the refrigerator for a week. All the sparkle, all the bubble, and all the zest has gone out of them. They taste flat and dull and heavy. Their life is fit only to be poured down the sink. But tastelessness or dimness was not Jesus' purpose for his followers in this world. We are to be salt and light, he said. We are to be flavorful and to be bright. That's the point of this passage. Now, as we review the preceding context, you can remember why the savory, dazzling expectations of Christ are exactly what you would expect for his disciples. It's what you would expect him to have. Remember, chapters 5 through 7 is a Sermon on the Mount. They are Matthew's example of the teaching that Jesus did on his Galilean preaching tour, as mentioned at the end of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 23 said, "And Jesus was going about in Galilee, teaching in the synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom." Well, the next three chapters are an example of what Jesus preached. And he started this sermon with a powerful and gripping expression of the character of the citizens of his kingdom. What we are to be like, what we are to live like. In eight blessings, he mapped out for us the essential qualities of the Christian life, of the Christ-like life. Blessed, he said, are the spiritually empty-handed, those whose hearts are sore over their sin. Citizens of God's kingdom, he also said in these opening verses, are gentle, i.e. mild, considerate, and yielding. They have a passion for being more like Christ that comes out in a hunger and a thirst for learning God's Word, for a perpetual desire for prayer and praise, a restless eagerness to overcome sin. They are merciful. They help the physically, emotionally, and spiritually hurting. They keep their minds clean. They play the peacemaker. They endure persecution. Those are the characteristics of citizens in God's kingdom. I once heard a youth pastor preach on this section, and he called it characteristics of a kingdom kid. That's the idea. This is what we are to be like. Citizens of God's kingdom can be typified in these ways. Now, we might say, as we look around certain nationalities, we might say, oh, Americans are brash, and the British are reserved, and Italians are loud. But if you want to describe someone from the land of Christ, a Christian, one of God's kingdom, you would say they are gentle, mourning, merciful, pure, and persecuted. Those would be the adjectives of choice. Now, those distinguishing characteristics from the Beatitudes of the opening part of the chapter, those distinguishing characteristics of Christ's followers mean something. They mean something. They mean that we will be flavorful and we will be bright. Those who show mercy in a selfish world will be like a dash of salt on plain rice. Those who are mild and considerate and yielding will be a beacon against a black background, the arrogant ambition and the lookout for number one attitudes of our world. Those who live the Beatitudes will be blessed by God, that's true. They will also, though, be flavorful salt and bright light in a tasteless and dark world. There's no way that citizens of God's kingdom can help it. You can't help but be tasteful and be bright. God made you that way. That is the purpose. Citizens of God's kingdom will be different. You put Christ's people in Satan's worlds, and they will stand out. They'll be like coming across a piece of biltong and a bag of health nut puffed rice cakes. It's just going to stand out, isn't it? They'll be like a diamond in the background of a field of black clay. They'll sparkle. They'll burst with flavor. Now, most people have a powerful aversion, though, to standing out in a crowd, don't they? Most of us have a powerful aversion to standing out in a crowd. We like to fit in. We don't like to be weird. We don't like to be different. But when you accepted Christ, you forfeited your right to pursue that. You see, we are to be like Christ. We are to conform to the holiness of God. We can fit in among the saints in the church. That's wonderful. But the world, that's not an option. Not a chance. That's like asking light to become shadow. It's like asking salt to taste like flour. It's just not possible. As a Christian, you are salt. You are light. And any hopes of hiding have to be abandoned from the very beginning. Citizens of Christ's kingdom will always stand out. If I can put it in a personal way that our congregation will understand, it's like putting Terence Zechfeld in the middle of downtown Tokyo. When you're a 3-meter tall blonde, you're not going to hide in a Tokyo train station. It's just not going to happen, right? That's the way it is with Christians. We are salt and light in a tasteless world. We might want to stoop. We might want to rub black shoe polish in our hair. We might want to let the snow of worldliness build up and dim our headlights, but it's not an option. You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth, said Jesus. Now, having summarized the point of the passage then, I think we can understand where it's going. That Christians can't hide. Having summarized that, let's go to the text. We can outline verses 13 through 16 in Matthew 5 this way. There's metaphors and there's a message. Metaphors and message. There are going to be two metaphors, salt and light, obviously. And those are verses 13 through 15. Two metaphors. In verse 16, you find the message or the point that Jesus is trying to teach by giving the metaphors. So let's start with the metaphors. A metaphor, of course, is a comparison. I think you understand that. It's comparison. We might say a rugby player is a real tiger on the playing field. We're making a comparison between his style of play and a tiger's ferocity, right? Or in winter, we might say, this hall is an icebox. That's a metaphor. It's a comparison pointing out a similarity between two things that you normally wouldn't consider similar. An icebox and a school hall. But in the case of the school hall in winter here, it's like an icebox, right? The similarity is the temperature. So, here in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus compared his followers to salt and light. Two things that you normally wouldn't think of comparing to people, to Christians, but Jesus used a metaphor and brought those two things together to show certain similarities. Verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. The first metaphor is salt. Salt. Now, obviously then, to understand the comparison between salt and Christ's disciples, as they would have been gathered there around him and he was preaching to them, to understand that comparison, we must determine the key characteristics of salt. Well, there are two basic uses of salt in the ancient world, preservation and flavor. Preservation and flavor. Salt is, of course, first a preservative. A preservative. The various bacteria that make food spoil are not overly fond of salt. Housewives know this, for example. A block of cheddar cheese left in the refrigerator too long will grow a beard of blue-green fuzz, right? But feta cheese that soaks in that little container full of salt water, that will be good for a month longer after you've had to throw the science project cheddar away, right? That's the preserving quality of salts. It preserves. That was widely known in the ancient world as well. As with biltong, for example, today, salt was rubbed into meat to make it last longer. Salt is a preservative. Salt was also used in the ancient world for flavor. For flavor. There's a couple of biblical texts that point to this. You can just write them down if you're taking notes. Job 6, verse 6. There Job asks, can something tasteless be eaten without salt? And depending on which side of the health food fence you ride, you'll answer that differently. I think we can probably guess what Job had in mind. Can something tasteless be eaten without salt? Colossians 4, verse 6 also says that you are to flavor or season your speech as with salt. You're to season it with grace, with mercy. So, salt was a preservative and it was a flavorant. Now, knowing its key characteristics then, we can see the comparisons Jesus probably intended in the metaphor. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. Christians are to function as a preservative and a flavorant in a morally decaying world. We are, if you will, a moral disinfectant. The world is evil, but how bad would it be if there weren't any Christians at all or never had been? On the macro level, the salt-like influence and flavor of Christians in the world is obvious as you would study history, for example. Some examples might be this. The influence of the Protestant Reformation on Western culture is absolutely immeasurable. Everything from the abolition of slavery to a noble work ethic to the elevation of women to the status of spiritual equals, all of that is traced directly to the Protestant Reformation. In the same way, who could measure the negative impact of the unbiblical practices of the Catholic Church in the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, right? They weren't being salt and light, they were being more like poison. I don't believe, however, that it is those kind of grand examples necessarily that Jesus had in mind. Those things are true. When Christians live the way they should, there will be times in history when we will have great influence. But I think Jesus probably had something more individual in mind as he spoke this little parable here, you are the salt of the earth. A Christian's most powerful influence in their world is not in culture, it's not in politics, it's not in anything like that. It comes on the individual level as we live out Christ-like lives. You can think of a multitude of examples of that. I spoke once with a couple of Christian employers who had observed the importance of a believer as a preservative in a godless society, preventing moral decay. They had observed this in their business. They had a small business, about 7 or 8 employees working under them. One of those employees was a Christian. While he was working for them, his Matthew 5 beatitude kind of peacemaking characteristics kept all the relationships in the office running smoothly. Ruffled feathers were calmed, tension was resolved without bitterness. I talked to those men about 2 years after that employee had left to go somewhere else. The difference, according to them, in their business was dramatic. Dramatic. With that believer's peaceful influence gone, the attitudes in the office had seriously decayed. Conflict had caused one long-term employee to resign. The others were grumbling and bickering and bad attitudes everywhere. That's an illustration of the preserving qualities of a believer. A Christian's level-headed biblical wisdom, willingness to yield, considerateness, and so on, that has a preserving quality in the areas of life and the environments in which he or she moves and lives. Your world is evil, but it's not as evil as it would be if you weren't in it. That should be true anyway, right? You are salt, combating the decaying effects of sin. Every time an unbeliever seeks your counsel, is convicted or motivated by your Christ-like example, is somehow directed away from evil, every time that happens, you're being salt. Now, the second key function of salt after preservation is also adding savor or flavor. Believers are like salts in the flavoring influence that we have in the world, similar to the first one. Let me explain it this way. You would never sit down with a knife and a fork and eat a steak-sized block of salt. I don't think you would ever do that. Kind of saw away and just, you know, munch on your little piece of salt there. However, you might also grimace if you had to eat a whole steak without any salt at all. And you could get it down, but you'd probably enjoy it a little bit more if it had some. Neither extreme is nice, is it? But when you sprinkle salts on steak, each grain penetrates and flavors everything around it, right? And believers are like that. There's a lot more unbelief than there is belief in the world. Christians are, by God, scattered all across the world, all across the globe, all across our earth. And like individual grains of salt, each one of us flavors or influences our world. Our beatitude kind of living is like salt to permeate our world. We are to dissolve, as it were, and just spread out, each little piece, each little one, influencing our world. We are to flavor or alter the godless taste of our society. So, we are God's salts, forestalling the moral decay of the world and penetrating it with saving flavor, the flavor of Christ. Now, having unraveled the metaphor then, let's consider the rest of the verse, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, first a note for the science-minded among you. Those of you who study these kind of things know that sodium chloride is a stable compound. Pure salt doesn't lose its saltiness. It's always salty, right? You can't lose its saltiness. And so some have accused Jesus of an error here, and, you know, the Bible's full of errors and all that sort of nonsense. What they don't understand is the historical situation. The salt used in ancient Palestine wasn't pure salt. They usually collected salt from the marshes and the areas around the Dead Sea. That's where Palestine got its salt. And that salt was heavily laced with other minerals, such as gypsum. Sometimes that which was supposed to be salty turned out, because of its impurity, to hardly be salty at all. And when it was found out to be in that case, that situation, it was just thrown out, right? They would haul it all the way from the Dead Sea, but sometimes it would just be useless. It would have no taste, and so they would throw it out. What use is unsalty salt? You can't build with it. It dissolves, right? You can't fertilize with it. It kills plants. Salt that is too impure to have a strong, salty taste is absolutely useless. And therefore, what they did, as this verse suggests, is they would just throw it out into the street until it was trampled into the dust because it was useless. I remember a year or two ago, we had a bag of salt that we bought at one of the local stores here. Bag of salt that was unsalty. We didn't know that at first. For a couple of days, I kept asking Ruthie if she'd forgotten to put salt on the food when she cooked it. She kept saying, "No, I did put salt." After she had used double the normal amount with no improvement, no change in the taste, we realized the problem. Unsalty salt. And so we just threw the bag away. What can you do with a bag of salt that doesn't taste salty? It's no use at all. That's what Jesus is pointing out. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt becomes tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. It's unthinkable, for salt to be unsalty. It's an unthinkable situation. If, due to impurities, salt becomes tasteless, it's as useless as snowshoes to a Bedouin. It has no use. Now, that's the first metaphor, salt. Let's turn our attention now to the second metaphor, light. We haven't quite seen the message yet, though perhaps it's coming through. We haven't seen the message because that will come through especially in verse 16. So I want to develop both metaphors before we drive home what salt is about, what light is about. So, we still need to determine then the message or the point of Jesus' comparison, but let's move to light, so understand that, and then we'll do salt and light together. So, the second metaphor or comparison is with light, verse 14. You are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. Now, most typically in the scripture, you find Jesus himself being compared to light. You can think of a number of examples. Isaiah said in Isaiah 9 that the people who walked in darkness will see a great light. He was speaking, of course, of Messiah. In Isaiah 42:6 and 49:6 as well, Messiah was called there the light to the nations. Jesus then took up that very terminology, applied the same descriptive terminology to himself. In John 8, verse 12, he said, "I am the light of the world, and he who follows me will not walk in darkness." Here, however, Jesus looked at the disciples who were gathered around him on the hillside there, and he said, "You are the light of the world. You are the light." Now, let's think about this for a moment. Based on the examples that Jesus used, I think you could say that probably the comparison he's trying to draw between Christians and light is this. Christians are illumination, and Christians are invitation. Illumination and invitation. He talks in verse 15 about putting a lamp up in the middle of the house, and it gives light to the whole house. What is that? Illumination. Illumination. Light helps you see. That's its key characteristic. Believers, then, are lights that God uses to illumine the lost, those who are living in the darkness of Satan's kingdom. He uses us as lights to illumine them. The light of our lives helps them see the shadows and darkness in their own. The candle of our holiness helps them see the noonday sun of God's holiness. And so, light is about illumination. In verse 14, you have a different kind of point being made with light, I believe. It talks about a city being set on a hill. That, I think, refers to invitation. Invitation. Because no one ever tried to read a book by the light of a distant city, right? Illumination isn't the issue in that metaphor. I think it's invitation. In the case of a city set on a hill with the lights in the distance, it is a welcoming beacon to the traveler. It's an invitation to come, to safety, to refuge. See, a lighthouse warns a ship in the storm to stay away from its dangerous rocks. The lights of a city set on a hill, however, welcome the storm-drenched travelers to come to it. It's a place of refuge. The peace and stability and joy of a godly Christian life is an invitation to the lost and stumbling of this world to come to the refuge of God. And so as salt preserves and flavors, so light illuminates and invites. You are the light, said Jesus. Now, All those things are true, and are the things that I believe need to be drawn from the metaphor of salt, metaphors of salt and light. We are to have taste in a tasteless world. We are to give flavor. We are to preserve. We are to be a message of invitation to a world that is full of darkness and chaos. We are to illuminate people so they can understand what the God who is light is like. Now, those kind of comparisons, however, are not the main point of the passage. They're important. They're part of the passage, but they're not the real point that Jesus is trying to drive home. So, think about it this way. Let's develop light first since we're on it. What was Jesus' point in sharing the illustrations of the lights and the salts? Think about the metaphor in verses 14 and 15. What aspect of light did Jesus especially focus on in the illustration of the city set on a hill? Verse 14. You're the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. You see, light welcomes, it illumines, it invites, that's all true. But Jesus' real point was this: light is unhideable. And that's an awful word, but it's the best I could do. Light is unhideable. Verse 14. You're the light of the world. What does that mean? A city set on a hill can't be hidden. What is it about light that I especially want you to understand as I compare you to light? You can't hide. Now, you've all probably seen the pictures of the ancient city mounds or tells in Palestine. Those ancient ruins always sit on a height, first of all, because the cities were usually built on an elevation for defense purposes. And those cities rose even higher with successive generations, as everyone would just build on the dust and the rubble of the last generation. Houses made of mud brick don't last forever, right? And they crumble into dust, and you just keep building right on top, and so it gets higher and higher and higher. Well, those two factors then make the elevated city a very common sight in Israel. And when you have a city blazing with light on top of a hill, what is it that is most true about that? Everyone can see it. You can't hide it. And that's what Jesus pointed out. If you've got a city sitting on top of a hill, you can't hide it. It's dark, all the lights in the city are burning, all the fires in the houses are on. You can't hide it. I'll never forget camping one Christmas. When I had a break and I was at seminary. Camping one Christmas in Death Valley, California. Death Valley is a fitting name for that place. It's utterly desolate. Dante could have taken a page or two of inspiration for his Inferno from Death Valley. The closest city of any size to Death Valley is about 240 kilometers away. Unfortunately, that city is Las Vegas. Now, the lights from the Strip, the huge hotels and all of that, the lights from Las Vegas are so bright that they dominate the nighttime sky of the infinitely desolate Death Valley. Light can't be hidden, can it? Las Vegas, in fact, if you've ever been there, it's in a basin. There are mountains all around it. If you put it on top of a mountain, you could probably see the lights of Las Vegas for about 1,000 kilometers. The point is, light can't be hidden. Jesus says you put a city up on a hill and you light all the lights, you can't hide it. Can't hide it. In fact, it is the very unhideableness, again, an awful word, but the unhideableness of light, it is that very fact about it that makes it so useful. Verse 15. The visibility that it brings, the fact that you can see it, is what makes it so useful. He says, nor do men put a lamp, light a lamp and put it under a peck measure, but they put it on a lampstand and it gives light to everyone who's in the house. The best thing about light is the fact that you can see it, right? You can see it. And then it helps you see. It's visible. No one, said Jesus, would be so dumb as to light a lamp and hide that light then under a pot. He explained the scene that Jesus is painting. It would have been clear in their minds. The basket, the bowl, the peck measure, the bushel, whatever your translation has in verse 15, was actually a clay pot used for measuring grain. It was just under 9 liters in capacity. It referred to a very specific size of pot. Used for measuring grain, it was 9 liters in capacity. That's the pot. You also need to understand this. In the poorer homes of New Testament Palestine, there's only one room. There was only one room. But when that house was built, what they would do, one of the stones in the wall, rather than being laid lengthwise, as you normally would in the wall, they would turn it and they would stick it out so half of it was projecting into the room. That was the lampstand. That is where you would light the lamp and put it on top of that projecting brick or stone. You would set it there so it would light the whole room, the whole house. That's what Jesus is saying. Now, it would take a major brain cramp to light the wick of the only lighted lamp in the house and then get a 9-liter clay pot and put over the top of the lamp, covering it completely. No one would be that dumb, right? The very purpose of light is to unveil. It is there to shine. It is there to be seen so you can see. You don't light a candle and then put it under a glass or a pot. You don't hide it. You hold it high so all can see. That's the very purpose of light. For example, I have a light in my office. I'm sitting at my computer typing this sermon. I look up, there's a light in my office. It's not in the bottom drawer of my filing cabinet. It's on the ceiling. Why? That's how light works. So, light is unhideable. Verse 14, it's like a city set on a hill. You can't hide. And in fact, verse 15, it's not even meant to be hidden. Light is meant to be seen. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under a peck measure or the bowl, the pot, but they put it on the lampstand and it gives light to everyone in the house. The very purpose of light is that it might be seen. Now, two metaphors then. Salt and light. What's the message? I think it's becoming obvious, isn't it? Salt that is tasteless is of no use to anyone. Light that is hidden is of no use to anyone. Let's see the message then. Verse 16. Let your light shine before men. The key to this passage is the imperative, the command right there at the beginning of verse 16. Here's the message. Let your light shine before men. That's the message. Christians must shine. We are light. But because of our innate sinful desire to fit in, our desire to be accepted by others, our desire to be men pleasers, we might be tempted to turn down the dimmer switch on the light, right? We might put the lights of our lives under a pot so no one will see and make fun of us. We might let the snow of worldliness build up so our light won't be so conspicuous. But light, you see, isn't meant to be hidden. It's not meant to be hidden. Our Christianity is no more meant to be hidden than an office light is meant to be put in the bottom drawer of a filing cabinet. Christ-following, beatitude living can't be hidden any more than a cook can disguise the fact that she oversalted the food. You can't hide salt. You can't hide light. That's the point. Let your light shine before men. So although the metaphors of salt and light allow many applications, this is the primary message of these verses. Jesus is saying, you, my followers, you can't hide. You may want to fit into the world, but you can't. Your saltiness must be tasted. Let your light shine before men. Salt that can't be tasted, light that can't be seen, is useless. Instead, said Jesus, be like a city set on a hill, which shines for everyone to see. Be like salt that brings taste that everyone can taste. So that's the message. We can't hide. We aren't made to hide. It defeats the very purpose of hiding or of Christianity. Salt that doesn't taste has no purpose. Light that is hidden has no purpose. Christians who are not living a life different than the world have no purpose. Let your light shine before men. Notice the purposes as they're listed out here. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. There are two goals for the shining at the end of the verse as Jesus works through the message. He says, here's what I want you to do. You need to be evident. You need to be seen. And there's two goals of that, he says. First goal is visibility. Visibility. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they see it. That they see your good works. Shining your light means living a godly lifestyle. That's obvious enough. Good works. And so the first goal is visibility. We are to shine. We're not to shine our intellectual prowess, our wealth, our success, or anything else. We are to shine our life-changed good works. We are to shine out the Beatitudes, right? That's obvious enough. The Beatitude kind of living of verses 3 through 12, that's what we are to shine. They are to be visible, those characteristics, they are to be visible in our lives so an unbelieving world can see. Can see. Shine it out, said Jesus. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they see your good works. You need to live and think and be different than the world. You can't be the same as them. It defeats the whole purpose of being a follower of Christ. Your salt, your light. Now, the second goal tells us that this isn't vain showing off. You might say, oh yeah, and I want to live all my good works so everyone can see what a great guy I am. No. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. The first goal is visibility. The second goal is glory. Glory. But it's not self-glory, it's glory to God, right? It's glory given to God. The people around us are to see the good works or godly lives that we live. They're to see that. However, the goal isn't for them to exclaim what a wonderful and fine fellow we are. It is for them to proclaim how wonderful God is. The self-righteous person does his good deeds so that men will think he is great. Salt and light kind of people do good deeds so men will think God is great. We, however, have a nagging desire to fit in. A nagging desire to fit in. A desire not to rock the boat. A desire not to make waves. A desire to go with the flow. Can I say it this way? Camouflage is not part of the armor of God. Ephesians 6. Camouflage is not part of the Christian soldier's equipment. If you want a soldier to hide in an enemy territory, you don't give him a 75-centimeter searchlight, tell him to turn it on and point it at the sky. It's not a good way to get him to hide. But that's exactly what Jesus commanded us to do. Christians are light. God doesn't mean us to hide. See, when the blood pressure patient invites his cardiologist over for supper, he can't hide how much salt there is in the food. Right? Salt by very nature bursts on the tongue. Christians are salt. You can't hide. We're light. You can't hide it. We aren't chameleons, if I can use that illustration. We aren't chameleons blending into the background. If we were birds, Christians would be macaw parrots or maybe the scarlet ibis. We're salt and light. And those are two things that just can't be hidden. So, the message of this passage is that as Christians, we need to jettison, throw out the desire to blend into our world. Jesus says, when you signed up for Christianity, when you came to the cross, when you bowed the knee, when you repented, when you said, I will follow Christ, you gave up the privilege to fit in. Because you're salt and light now. He didn't say, be salt, be light. He said, you are. Whether you want to be or not, it's just not a choice. You are salt and light, and that means you have a purpose, and that purpose is to stand out. Well, the purpose of that standing out isn't to draw attention to yourself, it's to draw attention to God. We always need to remember that, right? Self-righteous people try to please other people. They try to get attention for themselves. Self-righteous children try to show off so their parents will think they're righteous. Self-righteous parents try to show off so their kids will think they're righteous. God says, no, you need to live godly so people will look at you and say, what a great God you serve. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and then glorify your Father who is in heaven. So because of our innate desire to run with the pack, Christians want to blend into the world. We're men pleasers at the heart. We want to be accepted. We worship that idol, the idol of acceptance. We call it peer pressure. The Bible calls it men pleasing. We want to fit in. We want to blend in with the world. That's part of our sinfulness. God, though, says, I made you as lights in a mine tunnel. I made you like salt on cardboard. And so you can't hide. You can't. He wants the world to see that he's holy. And we're the tool that he's chosen. Now, to conclude this morning, I want to do this with us. I want to not only warn you generally against conforming to the world and blending in, which is certainly the point of this passage. I don't want to just warn you of that, though, and say, okay, stop trying to blend in, stop trying to fit in, and then you go away and you're not really sure what that looks like. I also want to give you some specifics. I want to warn you how the Bible says you might be trying to fit in and not even aware of it. None of these are especially new. We've talked about most of these before. But it's good to be reminded. It's good to be reminded and check our lives. God made us salt and light. There are two things you can't hide. But oh, how we try to hide them. Let me share with you four ways that we might hide our light or dull our saltiness. Thus disobeying Matthew 5:16, let your light shine. We can cover them very quickly. The first way that you might be dimming your light as you shine in front of the world is this: grumbling and complaining. Philippians 2, verse 14. Philippians 2, 14 and 15 is the first way that we might unwittingly or quite wittingly be hiding our light. Philippians 2, 14 and 15. Do all things without grumbling and disputing. Here's the purpose: that you might prove yourselves to be blameless, innocent, children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. You're to be a light, says Paul, and here's a great way to be a light. If you want to be a 200-watt bulb and not a 25-watt bulb, try this one, he says. Don't complain. Don't argue. How do we shine our light in the world? By not grumbling and disputing, by not complaining and arguing. This verse oozes conviction. I don't really need to do anything but read it. We're all struck down. When we complain and argue, we dull the saltiness of our witness. We dim the light of our testimony. Ah, he's no different than anyone else. He's got the same bad attitude that all the rest of us have. And so the first way that we can shine our light so that God is glorified is to avoid complaining and arguing and put it on with a positive replacement, which would be being thankful. Willingness to yield. Right? That's how you're going to let your light shine. Here's a second way that we might be putting our light under a pot: by not honoring authority. Not honoring authority. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter 2:12, Peter gives you an indication that he was there that day when Jesus preached this sermon, because he virtually quotes it. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Let your behavior, good works, be seen among men. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God. So Peter says you need to live in a certain way so that unbelievers will look at you, see you, and glorify God. Well, what did he have in mind? Verse 13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Peter continued on in the context to mention the government, employers, and husbands. When we don't submit to or honor Doesn't mean just teeth-grinding obedience, but honor as well, how you talk about them and so on. When we don't submit to or honor the God-established authority in our lives, we lose our Christian favor. We become like the anti-authority, I know best, no one tells me what to do worlds. Our light is snuffed out like a candle the moment we dishonor authority, even if it's failing authority. And we won't always agree with authority, fine. But when we move from disagreement to dishonoring them, talking badly about them, treating them badly with our attitude, or disobeying. When we move from disagreement to speaking dishonorably or refusing to submit to that authority, be it government, employer, husbands, parents, whatever, when we do that, we've turned off the light. Turned off the light. How many Christian young people turn off the light of their reputation, turn off the light of God's glory because they criticize their parents in front of their peers at school? Peter says you become useless to God's glory. Should be thrown out into the street to be trampled underfoot if you talk bad about your boss behind his back at work with the other employees. So, when you dishonor authority, you turn out the light. Right? A third way that we might be guilty of dimming our light is found in Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5. Here's a way that we are guilty of dimming our light rather than shining it out. Ephesians 5, verses 3 and 4. Paul says, "Do not let immorality or any impurity or greed even be named among you as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness, silly talk, or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather," here's the replacement, "giving of thanks. The content of our conversation," verse 3, "and our entertainment," verse 4, are a third way that we can become tasteless, useless for flavoring the world. If salt tasted like plain pasta, you wouldn't put it on your spaghetti when you cook it, right? Why? They taste the same. There's no point. In the same way, why would God sprinkle Christians all over the world as flavor if we taste exactly the same as the world in our conversation and what we laugh at? Be careful that what you talk about and what you laugh at doesn't dim your light. Because you've become so much like the world, no one can tell the difference. Here's a fourth way that our Christian light is dimmed. Let's turn over a few pages to Colossians chapter 2. Fourth way. Our Christian light is dimmed when we accept and promote the world's thinking. When we accept and promote the world's worldview. A worldview is how you viewed life, the grid through which you see life. How you think, how you evaluate, how you analyze, how you describe people's behavior or actions, so on. That's your worldview. When we accept and promote the world's worldview or thinking, we've lost our light. Colossians 2, verse 8. "See to it," says Paul, command, "make sure that no one takes you captive through philosophy, empty deception." It's human wisdom. That human wisdom, it's according to the tradition of men, it's according to the elementary principles of the world, it's rather than according to Christ. When Christians embrace theologies and isms of the world, we put out our light. It concerns me, for example, to hear the church described in the terms of the marketplace, as if we were a business after market penetration. It concerns me to hear sin relabeled as a neurosis or some other psychological terminology. It concerns me to hear Christians speak of world events as if God were not sovereign, the same as the analysis you get on the television news. When our worldview is taken captive or kidnapped by the world, we start describing things the same way the world does. And when that happens, we have lost our lights and our salts. Whether it's the church, human behavior and motivations, whether it's world events, when we describe them and think about them in the same way, in the same terms as the world does, we have lost our saltiness. We have lost our usefulness to God because we use the same terminology and thinking as the world does. We no longer stand out. And that's the very thing we are supposed to do, stand out. When we think like the world does and use their terminology rather than God's, we've ceased to be distinct. We've dimmed the light, the salt has become useless. Well, we could list many others, but I think those four will be a good start for you. There are four ways that the Christian pulls the curtains or puts the pot over the light of his life. We complain and we argue. We treat authority disrespectfully. We are just like the world in our conversation and entertainment. We promote worldly wisdom and terminology rather than God's. In contrast, Jesus said, "Let the light of your beatitude, lifestyles, and thinking shine in front of men." You are the salt, he said. You are light. Your standards and values won't fit into Satan's world. Good. That's the way it should be. If you do fit in, then you become useless to God. Too like the world to bring him glory anymore. And so Jesus said, don't hide. Shine. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works, not to glorify you, but that they might glorify your Father who is in heaven. Let's pray. Lord, it is in our sinful nature to want to hide, to want to fit in, to be the same, to be accepted. And you simply don't allow that. You have a greater and higher purpose, and that is your glory. It's a worthy purpose. It's one that we respect and honor and love and delight in. Help us, Lord, to set aside our sinful desires, to let our light shine, to let people see it, not so that we would be complimented, but that so you would be glorified. Lord, give us courage. Give us bravery. Give us the strength to stand before the eyes of a watching world, to live beatitude kind of attitudes and actions, so that they might see that you truly are a holy and great God. Make us adornments or decorations on your doctrine, as Paul says it in Titus 2. Lord, make us lights in the world. Make us salt. Make us difference, like you, so that people will come to know you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.